to the Planning Community Development Committee meeting for Monday, August 16th. And I'm Kathy Holgarty, the chair, and welcome to my fellow council members, Verna Steele and Tom McLeod, who are also my fellow committee members. So, the first item on the agenda today is a ordinance.
I can't hear. There we go.
Yeah, I was going to say, you and I are the only ones with, the three council members are the only ones with mics on right now, which is great. So I don't know what's going on. It's about an ordinance to implement code amendments related to House Bill 1220 relating to emergency supportive and transitional housing. This was in our committee, I don't remember the date, but it was June 7th, so a couple of months ago we had it in our committee. And today's ask, let me get to the very end of the project, is to move this along, basically. So, because if you recall, if we want to have an ordinance that has any sort of regulation for these shelters, we have to have it voted on and in place by September 30th. And we still have a public hearing to go through. And I have too many little stickies on my page. So the council is being asked to hold a hearing on this item at the September 13th Committee of the Whole and approve the order at a subsequent September 20th regular meeting. So that means we're going at a good clip here. I know we're missing meetings because of the holiday. So here we are. And as you recall, we've gone through this and we made some changes, and we now see it in the form of an ordinance in front of us. And so, Nancy, are you going to start this out? Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Nancy Eklund, Long Range Planning Manager. As Nora mentioned to you when she was here before, planning staff, and you know this already, planning staff has been up to their eyeballs with current planning, and for that reason, she took on doing most of the work on this particular sort of long range item. She's been working quite a bit with Emily Miner from the city attorney's office. And so Emily is going to shepherd this through this committee meeting. But if you have any questions, I'll be happy to see what I can do to address those. So go for it, Emily.
Thanks, Nancy. And thank you, council members. It's good to be here with you again. I have a PowerPoint that I'm just going to run through real briefly, and feel free to stop me as we go along, but I'll also have an opportunity for questions at the end. So with that, I'm just going to share my screen here and we'll get started. All right. So as indicated, we're here to talk about House Bill 1220. It's a zoning code update that has been handed down to us from the state legislatures.
Emily?
Yes.
Is it true that we don't have this presentation in our packet, correct?
You do not. I just put it together today, but I'm happy to share it around afterwards.
Okay. Thank you.
You know, and that would be good too. And also, just before we get started, is there an attachment B? I don't see an attachment B because it said the Planning Commission held a public hearing, amended the draft ordinance language, and recommended the zoning code changes shown in attachment B. Is attachment B the ordinance?
Yes.
Oh, all righty then. I'm good.
Okay. Thank you. Good clarification. That was on us. Yes.
No,
fair enough. Okay. All right. We're off to the races now. So as mentioned, this is a new state law. It's effective at the end of September. And the focus is really on directing cities who plan under the GMA to better plan and accommodate for affordable housing, not just encourage it. So the state is really trying to get us to think about in a more proactive way how to accommodate affordable housing in our jurisdictions. So there's two main components of the bill. One is to do these comprehensive plan requirements. There's a whole list of things that we'll be working on to be addressed in the next plan update. And then there's also some suggested updates to account for specifically accessory dwelling units. Those aren't mandatory changes, but they are recommended, and we'll be picking those up later, I believe, in first quarter of next year or potentially second quarter. There's a whole kind of host of other things that we want to consider along with that, in addition to what's been outlined in that bill. So that's to be coming down the pike in, later on. All right. So again, these are mandatory changes. They're aimed at distributing the need for affordable housing kind of equitably across all jurisdictions. And the key takeaway is that they are going to be allowed where housing and hotels are currently permitted. So this is a shift from what we've how we've currently regulated these types of facilities in the past. So emergency shelters and housing, and I think it's important to note that it's indoor emergency housing and shelters must be permitted uses where hotels are permitted. And you see the different zones there where hotels are permitted. And then transitional and supportive housing must be permitted where housing or hotels are permitted, and that's in all the zoning districts in the city. And I just a quick note here, we're treating the houses operated by the Wayback Inn as domestic violence shelters, which are different than what is being regulated here. So we just wanted to note that for you. They're accounted for differently. So a brief background, it's already been covered, but just want to do it again real quick. You were briefed on this back in June. Planning Commission held a public hearing on July 22nd. We had a really robust, positive discussion. Really good comments and revisions were recommended. Those have been accounted for here in the packet that you see tonight. And then today we're asking for you to review the ordinance again. And then if there are any revisions, we'd be happy to take those under advisement. But then hopefully forward this on to the Committee of the Whole meeting in September. So just a reminder of what we can control, because while this is sort of a kind of handcuffing mandate that we have to allow these facilities in all zones, we do have some kind of guidance that we can use to help regulate how this impacts the city. So specifically, we can regulate the reasonable occupancy spacing and intensity of use, but those regulations are going to be measured against whether they prevent the siting of a sufficient number of these facilities based on each city's projected needs as determined by the Department of Commerce. So we can regulate a little bit, and I'll go into kind of what those regulations look like here next. But before I get there, we will be adding definitions to the code that account for these types of facilities, the four types, the emergency shelter, emergency housing, permanent supportive housing, and transitional supportive housing. So those are the four types of uses that we're now going to be adding to our code. And then next up are the types of guidelines that we're going to be asking these types of facilities to follow. So the facilities need to be 24/7 facilities. They have to have assigned rooms. They have to have access through a secured entrance, so it's not just generally open. They have to be located within a half-mile walking distance of a transit stop. They have to have a half-mile separation between the facilities themselves. We have maximum facility sizes. Shelters are at 45 residents. And then transitional and permanent supportive housing, it'll vary based on the type of zone that it's in. And the idea there is just to decrease the impact of these types of facilities in each of the different zones. And then lastly, we're going to have a memorandum of agreement that is supposed to help address in advance any potential issues that these kind of facilities may present to the neighborhood or the local kind of area. We'll have a good neighbor agreement. It covers everything that you see there, quiet hours, smoking areas, landscaping, screening, et cetera, a code of conduct for residents. There's going to be a parking plan. You have to park off-site, on-site, so you can't park on the street. And then we also set a threshold for calls for service to make sure that we're not exceeding that, and it's tied to what everybody, you know, other types of facilities in the city so that we're treating everybody the same. And then regular reports to make sure that everything is tracking the way it's supposed to be. So next steps, as we discussed earlier, we're going to discuss the ordinance language tonight. If you have any amendments or questions, we can definitely address those, and then we're going to make a recommendation to City Council. There's some motions there if you want to take a look at them, but I can also close my screen and we can have a more less distracted conversation.
Okay, so all we need to do, Emily, here is move it forward by consensus, so we don't need to have those motions, but thank you for those.
Fair enough.
That's how we do it here. So we'll start the discussion then. Most of everything were things that we talked about. There were some tweaks, I think, by the Planning Commission, but they agreed with all the things that we had said. So we're good. So let's start with Verna and see if you have any questions.
Yeah. So I'm looking at the changes. I'm looking at the changes to the markup to, I guess it's the draft ordinance. And so a couple things. First of all, I think it would be helpful to see the planning meeting minutes where they discuss this in the packet when it goes to full council. I think that would be helpful because I'd like to see their deliberations, and the minutes are usually pretty good with that. So I'm looking at all of these additions to the ordinance. Now, were these, because I don't recall us drafting specific language. So my question is, was this specific language here presented to the Planning Commission, or did the Planning Commission come up with this language?
So good question. It was not in specific ordinance format, but this framework that you see here was proposed to the Planning Commission. So they saw the actual ordinance language that they were proposing. They did make a couple shifts. They specifically changed the number of residents. We had initially proposed 75 maximum number of residents in all jurisdictions, in all zones, and they've reduced that down to 45 for shelters, and then a tiered approach for the other types of facilities, the transitional supportive housing and the transitional housing and the permanent supportive housing. And they also made some changes related to the memorandum of understanding. They required the service calls to be tied to Title V, your code there. And then they also required the access to be via the secured 24-hour indoor secured access. So there were some minor tweaks to it.
Right. Okay. So for example, specifically, I'm looking at page 5 of 6 of the ordinance, which is page 13 in the packet.
Yes.
Paragraph number 4. So
yes.
If I'm reading that, I believe what they're doing is that's the same criteria that we use for hotel or motels. In other words, so many calls for service, blah, you know.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, there's a tiered response depending on the number of calls per service. So it escalates with the number of calls. You have to have a higher, requirement threshold.
Okay. And then going back to page 3, so I'm looking under 18.06743 domestic shelter. It says domestic shelter means a one-on-one or two-unit residential building, then or use provided. There's some strikeouts here. So were those strikeouts as for recommendations from the Planning Commission then, but the original?
No, this was specifically drafted by Nora as an intent to remove domestic shelters outside of the concept of just shelter. So previously it was just shelter and then the language that you see there, but then the word domestic was added and then the limiting it to a one or two unit residential building. And again, the intent there was to just set aside the domestic shelters from the requirements of the rest of the emergency housing shelters.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, that's my questions for the moment, but I think it would be helpful too to know what the planning, what did the Planning Commission add, or, maybe a different color for Planning Commission. And I would really like to see their minutes. I was going to go back and try to pull them today and ran out of time.
We can send them. No problem at all.
Thanks.
Absolutely.
I yield back.
All right, Tom.
Okay. Thank you. Emily, a couple questions. You called this a handcuffing mandate. What happens if we do not do it? What are the consequences?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's one that all jurisdictions are wrestling with because this is affecting all jurisdictions in the state. And I think what would happen is that somebody could come in and propose one of these facilities, and we would have to we then have two options. One would be to try and fit them somehow within the current code and uses that we have today. And then the other option would be to just deny their application outright because they don't fit within any of the uses. And in that case, they would very likely challenge their authority, you know, our authority to do that under the statute and the fact that we're not in compliance with the statute. And we would struggle to defend that decision.
Okay. First of all, I'm all for this going to the COW. But maybe, you know, that type of thought, can you make a paragraph there that, like, if we didn't do it,
what would happen? Yeah.
What would happen? Just so we can be looking at this from all sides.
Sure.
That's one thought. I think we all could probably then piece together the steps that would go forward if someone applied and we denied and where that might go. I have a question. I'm on page 5 where the Good Neighbor Agreement is listed. And who enforces that, or what if the facility isn't operating according to a general understanding of a good neighbor?
Right. So that's a great question. I mean, it will be handled as similar to all other code enforcement that, you know, the neighbors make a complaint to the city. The city would investigate, pull up that good neighbor agreement, see if there, you know, if the complaint is actually valid based on what the good neighbor agreement says, and we'd have to move forward with enforcing it from there. So I think it'd be a kind of a wraparound approach with both the police, depending on what the violations are, and then DCD, you know, code enforcement.
In the past, there would be a lot of residents that would say that our code enforcement isn't that strong or that great. So now I know they recently hired some people. So I just wonder, you know, when we talk about a good neighbor agreement, how do we make sure that has teeth that, you know, we could use if need be? And I don't know what that would be, but if we just default to, well, code enforcement will take care of it. We got some neighbors that would say, well, that's not going to be much enforcement at all. And I just want to know that we have a really good agreement here that would say that, no, they're going to comply. And if they don't, there really are some consequences to it. So I'm not sure how to give that area more teeth, but that would be a question. The parking plan, can the residents of these facilities have visitors and guests? And then would they be parking in those spaces? So are we really allowing enough parking?
Right.
For them, I mean, if I had somebody there that I knew, I might want to go see them. And where am I parking?
Fair enough. We hadn't considered that. So that's a great question.
Okay. And then under emergency services, I didn't understand the connection to Title V that you referred to, but I'm concerned that, again, maybe this goes back to being a good neighbor. If they get a lot of calls, then how are we handling that to where our handling of it creates change?
Sure. So the TMC 560 has a escalating number of calls and then correlating requirements on the facility. So depending on the number of calls, and it's like number of calls per number of units there, certain requirements need to be met. And so that's how that's the correlation there with those two things. Does that help?
But if they go beyond a certain number of calls, what's the corrective action that happens?
Well, I think ultimately the corrective action is that they have harsher and harsher requirements that they have to meet. And if they can't meet those, ultimately their business license gets pulled.
Okay.
Per TMC 560.
Okay. Is TMC 560 a big paragraph to include or not?
There's a lot to it. The reason we did a cross-reference is because there's like 6 or 7 different escalating factors.
Maybe I'll look that up then. Okay, thank you. Let's see if I have any other questions. I might have one more. Oh, yes. This is in attachment B on page 5 of 6. It talks about the good neighbor agreement addresses the following items: quiet hours, smoking areas, security, litter, landscaping, screening. What about things like drug use or any of that? Does that not need to be mentioned because it's illegal?
I think that was the intent, but we could certainly take that back for consideration. I mean, the idea is that if the idea for this is addressing things that aren't automatically addressed in another way. Drug use is illegal, but we can certainly kind of think about other things that we may have missed that should be encapsulated there.
Yeah, well, you don't have to include that one. I'm just trying to think out loud. When we talk about what makes a good neighbor agreement, you know, does quiet hours need to have time specified? Can you put no fireworks?
No bottle rockets.
At 2 a.m.
Yes, right. But at 2 p.m., it's okay.
No, yeah, can they have pets?
That's a good one. Okay.
I see you, Ruma.
I'll speak again.
So I'm just trying to, you know, if I'm living next to a facility or any neighbor that I've got, you know, what do I like or not like and vice versa, that makes it for a happy arrangement.
Absolutely.
So I'll yield back at this point.
Okay, so I have a few comments. One is the good news is that we don't need to finesse the good neighbor agreement right now. That is something that is separate from the ordinance, so we can have some conversations about that in the future. As far as the enforcement of the good neighbor agreement, a lot of it because it's got to be community pressure, but I still think that it's very useful, to have, because you'll be at talking to the owner or whoever's running, the manager, and saying, look, we as a neighborhood don't think that this is acceptable behavior in some particular area. And I think that's going to be really useful to have. And then, Verna, regarding what the Planning Commission added, so if you start on page 2 with me, I'm just going to walk it through. It tells you right here. So in shelter type, if you look at the last paragraph, it says they added first of all, carte blanche. They agreed with everything that was on the ordinance, and those were things that we all agreed on in our planning and in our PCD meeting in June. So they said yes, and add the secure entrances and staffing 24/7.
Yeah, and that's fine. I would just still like to see their minutes.
Okay.
I'd like to see their minutes.
Okay. And then the next one was that what I really like was the maximum size, and there is attached sizes of different facilities in the appendices, and this just seems to line up right with this. So staff must have proposed those different numbers. And they seem to line up with what's in the appendix. So I liked that. Really liked the idea of having them conform to the same laws and ordinances that hotels and apartments, I think hotels, have to go with. So, yeah. So I think this is a good product. The next time we meet as PCD is going to be on the 20th of September, so that's over a month from now, and then we've got to pass it really soon after the next meeting. It's a COW, and we have to have a special meeting after to pass it, or I didn't look at that.
So my understanding is that it is going, we're asking for a recommendation to go to the Council of the Whole meeting on the 13th for a public hearing, and then we're looking for an adoption at the following meeting on the 20th.
Okay, so that would be the council COW.
So it does not come back to committee.
No,
it's not coming back to committee, but we can look at it at the COW.
Yeah.
And they really do want to get that. If we have anything, then we should probably be talking to staff about it between now and then, so we can keep it moving. Okay, that sounds good. Any other thoughts, Vernon? Did you have anything else?
Just the good neighbor agreement. I mean, you know, I think about good neighbors and I think about my neighbors, and gee, don't I wish some of my neighbors and I had a good neighbor agreement. You know, as much as we want to, I mean, I think there's certain things we could try to legislate, you know, certain things we could deal with and certain things we can't. I mean, the pet one is a big one. When you say drugs, what's a drug? Alcohol, marijuana, those are legal. Other drugs are not. So those are, I'm just thinking purely from how can we enforce it? You know, you can have an agreement, but it has to be enforceable. And so I think if it's too prescriptive, and almost, it just something about it bothers me, and I don't know what. But anyway, we can move on. Those are just my thoughts.
I think those
are Tom, you really do like pets. I know you do.
Yes. More dog parks.
We have a cat. So that's all there is to it.
Okay, Kathy wants a cat park. There is These are good things, and I just like looking at it from all different sides, and then we talk about it, and we'll come to a good place at the COW. So I'm all for it moving forward.
Yeah, and was it? Could we have different good neighbor agreements for different facilities? Because it might depend.
Well, that's the point of them being sort of the code not being super prescriptive with the agreement. It's supposed to outline the kind of concepts that are going to be in the good neighbor agreement and then have flexibility to have discretion to accommodate the specific facility and the neighborhood itself. So that's the idea there, is to have a little flexibility.
I have a question. Does the neighborhood get to weigh in on the good neighbor agreement?
You know, we hadn't intended it to, but that's certainly something that we can look at from a planning perspective. I mean, I think the concern would be how to get the notice out. Of course, you know, the project would have to go through a typical building permit and, you know, noticing requirements there. So I think it would just be kind of a conversation with staff internally of how we would get stakeholder input, stakeholder being the neighbors. So something to consider. And I'd have to defer to Nora on the kind of the specific internal process related to that.
And would you consider the voice of business, the business community, in a good neighbor agreement?
They're stakeholders. I would think so. I mean, I think that's important to understand.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So do we have consensus to send this off to the September 13th COW meeting?
Yes.
Okay. You got your consensus there, Emily. Off it goes.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. We'll see you then.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Okay.
Right, so the second item and last item on our agenda is the Wattajir development update. And what we're being asked to do regarding this is to discuss it. I'm sure we're going to have some ideas and thoughts about it, but the next step is for staff to work with the applicant to begin open public outreach to the neighborhood about the project. I'm reading this from page 43, if you want to see. So the outreach would include information about the project, impacts to the neighborhood, and possible mitigation measures. So we're getting where we are right now in the status of this project. We're getting this point in time. So that's, and you'll see how, where they are on the project with Forterra. So who is going to lead this?
Council member, that would be Brandon. He just notified me he had a technical issue and is rejoining the meeting.
Okay. And that's why we'll wait for him. And then I know that he's going to have the Forterra, Forterra people will be talking. So Brandon, here you are. Take it away.
Yes. So thank you. And just as a reminder, if you're not a committee member, if you could please turn your camera off and you mute yourself, so it helps with the presentation. So I'm going to give a quick presentation and an overview of the Forterra Wattajir project. I'm going to share my screen for a presentation I have. I want to just stress, this is no new information. I'm simply doing, you have all of this information in your packet. I simply kind of did this to be able to keep the conversation kind of guided tonight and to keep it structured. Can I make sure, can someone tell me if they can see my screen? Okay. So tonight, before the committee, is what we want to do tonight is to provide you an update on the Wattajir project. This is being proposed by Forterra and the Abu Bakr Islamic Center at the Ode Night End project. We're here today to answer questions that the committee might have. There are no decisions that are required tonight. This is simply to give an update to the committee, and then we want to discuss next steps. Specifically, we want to start have a discussion and get the okay to start doing some public engagement within the neighborhood. As a reminder, the Knights Inn project is located directly across the street from the Abu Bakr Islamic Center on International Boulevard. Forterra is proposing to use cross laminate and modular building for 100 units of co-op housing, which is owner occupied, and approximately Hang on, let me get my notes here. And approximately 15,000 square feet of commercial space. That space would be used for 60 micro retailers as well as a small restaurant. The site is located within the Tukwila International Boulevard corridor, and it is located in our urban renewal area. On the left of your seat, the hash area that shows the urban renewal area. The property has split zoning, which is common in some of our properties up there. It's zoned NCC along International Boulevard, and then to the rear of the property, it's zoned MDR, medium density residential.
Question?
Yes.
What does UROD stand for?
It's the Urban Renewal Overlay District.
Thank you.
The district's probably not the right term there. It's just the urban renewal overlay.
Okay.
So this gives an approximation of the mass of the project. This is a modular building that would be brought in components, the building would face along International Boulevard. And what Forterra is proposing is to have the parking in the back. This design is very consistent with an urban environment. The height is within the allowable height of the underlying zone. This shows an approximation of that site plan. Again, you see the building is fronted along International Boulevard, and then the parking is located in the back. And then Forterra is also showing along the north some additional parking that they would install as part of this project along the right-of-way for South 141st Street. So I want to remind the council, this is an application for a development agreement. A development agreement is a legislative action by the city council. It's not quasi-judicial. It's completely discretionary. The council, like it would approve an ordinance or a resolution, does a thumbs up, thumbs down vote after doing a public hearing. It goes through a process of review by the city council. It can go through the committee process like we're currently doing here. As staff has gone through the application, we've identified five major issues. 1 through 4 really could have an impact on the project. And what we want to do today is to give you an overview of those. And provide some space for you to ask questions or to give us some guidance. But we really want to keep it at a high level. The other thing that is not something that's subject to a development agreement, but is something that Forterra has asked, is that the city readopt its multifamily tax exemption program. And I'll talk about that at the end of the presentation. So the first thing that I just want to give you discuss is structure parking. Forterra is requesting that we waive the structured parking requirement within the urban renewal area. Within that urban renewal area, we require that 75% of the required parking be within a structure. That requirement was met both at Tukwila Village as well as the Bellwether project, which is located to the south. Forterra, structure parking raises, there's two ways of doing structure parking. One is you do it subterranean where you put it underground. The other is that you do above ground structure parking, or of course a combination where you do both. Structure parking adds a layer of project costs. And one of the concerns that Forterra has mentioned is that that would add a cost and hinder the affordability of the project. The next thing, and perhaps one of the biggest items, is the minimum parking requirement. So if we were to go over our parking standards for this project, it would require approximately 203 parking stalls using our code. Forterra is requesting that 69 of the parking, that only 69 parking spaces be on site, and then that 32 be installed along South 141st Street. In the past, when we've granted parking reductions for a project, we've reduced our ratio, but we did that with Tukwila Village, Bellwether, as well as the Washington Place project in the South Center District. In those cases, we allowed a lower required parking count to be provided, but we required that entire count be on site. What Forterra is proposing is that they're asking that 32 of those stalls, that 69 stalls be on site, and an additional 32 would be along South 141st in the public right-of-way, public street parking that they would want to get credit for their project. That is a bit unusual in our code. We have proposed a way to kind of address that. And in my memo, you'll see some ideas that we have of how to address parking and how to mitigate impacts to the parking. With related to that parking along that's in the 141st Street, one of the suggestions is that we could vacate 141st Street. This would take all of that area and at least take half of it, the south side, and put it into their property. The north side would initially go to the mobile home park that's located to the north, and Forterra could negotiate with that property owner to get all of that part that vacated right of way, and then they could use it for parking. If they did that, now it would become on street or on site parking, and their parking count would go up to just over 100 stalls of on site parking. That is still below what our code requires. However, it is consistent with a parking study that they had that Forterra had submitted that talks that about low 90s is what this site would require for parking. Some other options that we have looked into or have kind of just some brainstorming is one is Forterra has suggested that they could get leased parking that where they go and find parking off site that they could lease for employees of the site. We have in the past allowed easements to be off-site where those easements exist indefinitely. So lease parking is a little bit different. Forterra has also proposed that stalls be allocated for a car share service. Our code does require that a minimum number of car share services be provided on-site. One of the concerns that staff has is are we essentially cannibalizing parking stalls to provide that car share service? Another way that you can do reduce parking demand is you reduce the scale of the project. So if you would take down the number of units or you reduce the number of the commercial space, that would reduce the demand, which would result in a reduced parking count. The applicant has expressed concerns that that might impact the financial feasibility of the project. Another thing is if we allowed some of that on-street parking to be used in the area to mitigate parking that would be happening on site, is that we could create a residential parking zone. These are very common in Seattle where residents in the area get a parking sticker that they would use, say, on 42nd Avenue. Residents are given special parking allocations, while people who don't live in the area and don't have one of those or get restricted parking, say, with only a few hours a day. We could look at forming a parking improvement district. That would be a much bigger and long-term strategy to address parking within the entire Chipola International Boulevard neighborhood. The applicant can provide us a parking mitigation fee to help with monitoring parking in the area and then doing better signage on some of the streets. And of course, the applicant can be required to provide structured parking. One of the things I want to just kind of note is that, you know, any of this mitigation, it's not we just pick one. There could be multiple items that we use to address the parking reduction that the applicant is proposing. So I think this is got in there by accident. Oh, I'm copying myself. The next thing that the applicant's requesting is an exception to building setbacks. So we have a provision in our code. The building will meet setbacks from the foundation. But what we have is a provision for our code that says that as the building goes higher, there needs to be modulation and that the building is stepped back. Because of the building construction design, which is to use those modular buildings, it presents an issue where you don't have the option of being able to do that type of modulation. So the applicant's requesting that we waive that building setback requirement for the upper floors. So this shows kind of what, as you can see, there's no modulation proposed. It's very linear. It is a very standard design that you might see in a more urban environment. It is, I think the Malvero project in the South Center District There's no requirement that you have that type of modulation down in the South Central District. So the other thing that, and this one is more driven, this is a request by staff. If we do this development agreement, we will be making, the council will be approving a significant amount of the project's design. The site plan will be set, modulation will be addressed, landscaping will be pretty much frozen. But one of the things that the applicant has asked, that staff is requesting is that we look at consolidating the review process and that we do administrative design. Since the council will review this anyway, and there will be a public hearing, we wanted to, if we chose to move this forward, we would do so in an expedited way once it's approved, once the development agreement is approved by the city council. I'm sorry, I'm going to skip to the rec space next. Recreation space is another request the applicant has made. It looks like they can actually meet all their rec space on site, but they have requested that part of the landscaped area be included in the minimum recreation requirement if they need it. We do not, under our code, give credit for the landscaped area. That is in addition to any required recreation space. There are ways that we can address this. First, I think the applicant and the city need to take a hard look at what the rec space is on site. We allow a 50-50 breakdown of half can be outdoors, half can be indoors. I think they might be very close to meeting that requirement without having to have this exception. But even if they did need this exception, one thing that staff would want us to consider is a fee in lieu of where the recreation space, if they need additional recreation space, instead of trying to say the landscape area would count, one idea would be that we require a fee in lieu of, and then we could use that for a future recreation space that the city would install in the area. And then I want to go back to the question of the multifamily tax exemption. Again, the multifamily tax exemption is not something that's eligible to be part of the development agreement. It would require a separate action by the city council. We did have a multifamily tax exemption in place for the South Central District of the city that was intended to help encourage bringing development down to South Central. That provision sunsetted, so we don't accept any new applications for that tax exemption. What it does is you can do, state law says that a city can do up to 8 years for market-based housing, and we can go up to 12 years if there's an affordability component. We have a lot of leeway in how we structure a program. For example, we could go and say a program is needs to have owner-occupied requirement within a certain neighborhood. So this will require a separate action. The multifamily tax exemption only applies to the residential component of the of a project. It does not apply to, say, a commercial component on the same site, nor does it apply to the underlying land value. So again, next steps, we think that we would like to work with the applicant to begin some outreach in the neighborhood about the project and about possible impacts to the neighborhood. And then we're having a discussion with the committee tonight. And so with that, that concludes my remarks, and I will stop sharing my screen now.
So should we have some remarks for Tara before we go to questions, or? Is that okay, Verna, with you?
Hi. Hi, Kathy. Hi, Verna. Good to see you again. Nice to meet you, Thomas. I didn't totally hear. We should make remarks now?
Yeah, I think so. Why don't we have all the information all thrown together before and again, this is an information session. We might have some remarks.
Okay.
Yes. The short answer is yes. Please proceed.
Okay. So there's not that much to say because that was an awesome presentation by Brandon. That was amazing. That captured basically 2 years of research into entitlement for the project. So thank you, Brandon. That was awesome. The only thing I would, there's only a couple things I would add. As you both remember from, it must have been right at the beginning of COVID we last spoke, because I remember I was still working out of my basement and still thinking I could remain sane that way at that time. And it was the main focus of the presentation at that time was around ownership, and it still is, right? This, what makes the project different is people can buy in. And that doesn't in any way impact any of the planning issues. I just like to say it because it's different, right? It's not rental. 100 families could potentially buy into here. 60 merchants, small business owners could buy into here. So we're hoping to have this wealth creation through the project. It's not built on the back of tax subsidy through LIHTC, right? So we're not, we feel like we're not burdening the LIHTC tax system through the project. We are asking for MFTE, which is, yes, another tax burden, but we're not trying to double up. We're not trying to double dip, I would say that. Other updates since we last spoke, the team, I don't know if the team wants to come on camera. Can everyone just come on camera for like 10 seconds? We brought the whole team so you could see how many people are actually working on this. Rebecca works on community engagement. Jan organizes construction. Elizabeth works on construction. Dan Grouse is our senior counsel, volunteer at Forterra, was on the Mercer Island City Council for many years, has been in your position. And Hillary Wilson, who does business development, who was on the call last time. So it's a big team. We're super dedicated. We're extremely happy to work with Brandon and Nancy and the team. And I would just three design things and then I'll be quiet. Yes, no modulation, but if you Google mass timber buildings, you'll notice that from the outside, when you look into a mass timber building, it is super warm and woody inside. It doesn't replace modulation, but it's a different kind of street presence. And personally, I find it really beautiful. And then I would say, obviously the two solutions, that great list that Brandon put up, of that great list, the two we want to minimize are reducing the project scale. The problem there is that we won't get the HUD guarantee, the FHA guarantee on the loan if we dip below 100 units. So the way we've structured it financially is as a cooperative, and HUD doesn't like doing small cooperatives that are under 100 units. So that one's tough. Hopefully we can avoid that one. Second one, of course, Brandon, you said this, is try to avoid structured parking, because our construction estimate says $5 million, and $5 million moves the AMI from the 80s, low 80s into the 90s and 100, and you start to get away from working families and more towards wealthier families. So yeah, those are our details. Happy to answer any questions about the project.
Okay, I'll start with Tom.
I do have a couple of questions. This one would be for Tobias, and then I'll have some for Brandon also. So can you just maybe a short summary of how that co-op piece works? I could buy, if I qualified, or how would I buy in? And then if the property appreciates because I bought in, I'm going to get the equity? That's how that works?
Sure. So it's simple and it's complicated. So a co-op is
simple side.
The simple side, it's a corporation owned by the members. Everyone gets one vote who owns a unit. That corporation is borrowing the loan for the most part instead of each person going and getting a mortgage. Everyone gets a mortgage for a little piece that's left, but the main loan is to the corporation. And that's why we had to get a house bill 2 years ago to lift the prohibition that inadvertently existed under Washington law prohibiting liens on commonly owned property. So we got that house bill passed, which was great. So co-ops were allowed. So now when you buy in, you're buying into this mortgage effectively that the corporation has. But what happens is your down payment goes massively down. Like your one bedroom down payment can go down to $8,000, right? So it allows, and we've been raising state subsidy. The team has managed to raise $3.8 million in state, federal, and county appropriations since we last spoke, specifically to subsidize in large part those down payments. But to answer your question, when you sell it on, after you've paid this relatively small amount, the inflation that, or the amount that you can sell it more for, is linked to the HUD cost of living index. So you can't speculate on the real estate market through, you can only raise it that cost, and that runs at 2 to 3% per year generally. To back that up, there's a deed restriction on the underlying property that the co-op can't dissolve that restriction effectively. So it's a two-layered protection for perpetual affordability.
Is the bulk of money then being put up by Forterra?
Through our Strong Communities Fund, which is not Forterra itself, but it's friends and family of Forterra, yes.
Okay. Are any of these units considered affordable, or does that not come into play here?
Oh, no, it does, very much so. So that's what I was talking about earlier. So we have committed to the 15 of those units to be at 60% AMI. So those would be really for household income, you know, under 50,000. Then we are working with every dollar saved through modular construction. Our target have rest at 80%. We won't get close to 80% without MFTE and with structured parking. Adding 5 million to 100 units is just a huge number.
Okay.
But that's our target, 80%.
Okay. There's a question I have on the site plan and the parking layout. And that is, I counted those spots, and the ones that are on 141st, are those considered to be in the number without vacating the street, or are those
right
in hopes of they would be like as it is now?
Yeah.
Okay. I think parking is going to be a problem because indirectly this unit's tied to the mosque, which already has parking problems. I don't think you'd be able to separate these two, mosque activity and this, even though they're separate. You know, it's just going to be people living there, going to the mosque, shopping at the stores, a circle of activity. So I think parking is a problem. But I'm open to the idea of vacating the street. And I think, did we get their study? I didn't know if I saw that in here as I was reading through it, where they said 90. So I'd like to see their study, unless I overlooked it, I have it already. And I think we got to meet more in the middle. I think our 203 is probably high. Their 69 is probably low. But I think parking's an issue. We've got to find a solution, and I'm open to a couple of the ideas I'm hearing here. And then I will also say, before I yield back, I think the recreation space, that keeps coming up and causing challenges in development. And what would happen if we got an email this afternoon with the recommendation? What if we just deleted it from this? If we're making a development agreement, what if we didn't have that requirement in there? And that, Brandon, may be a question for you.
Brandon does have his hand up, so.
Let me.
And then I yield back.
Let me just remember how to lower my hand. So to kind of answer the questions in reverse order, through a development agreement, you can waive recreation space. You can change that requirement. The one thing I would just put out there for the council to consider is some of our older projects on Tukwila International Boulevard that were developed in the county had no recreation space, and we've regularly heard concerns about the lack of any type of activity on sites for kids to play. I do think the Forterra project, there's a courtyard that's being proposed. I do think that if we were to look at recreation space, I think we should make sure that young children have the ability to do stuff on site. And that can be indoor or it can be outdoor. We're talking about this. We talked about it earlier. We talked about it later. You know, Tukwila South, we're talking about this idea of offsite recreation space. And in fact, we're encouraging offsite recreation space. I do think there's some advantages to having larger offsite recreation spaces managed by one entity or the city versus having smaller individual locations on apartment buildings. Yeah, one thing I forgot to say about the parking on South 141st, if they vacate the entire roadway and Forterra is able to gain the ability to use the north side of South 141st, there's additional parking that could be available to be installed there. We would still need to look at whether how that is designed and how many we can fit, but that provides an option for perhaps even more parking. And council member, I will shoot out to the whole committee a copy of that parking study. I didn't want to flood the council with a lot of the information, but I can do that afterwards.
Thank you.
Okay, Verna.
All right. So a couple. Well, first of all, this is very exciting. I mean, the possibility of having, you know, 100 places for people to be and 60 micro retailers and a small restaurant is exciting. I mean, to me, that is exciting. So I would like, you know, I sure hope that after I'm gone, this keeps going or I'm going to be sitting in the back of the room. But anyway, just kind of my thoughts, kind of along the same lines, a recreational space. We have, you know, the person that sent us an email this afternoon is absolutely right. We've been hearing about our play recreational spaces is somewhat unduly burdensome. But on the flip side of that, you're absolutely what Brandon said was right. We have these apartments that we've annexed in from King County that have no place for children to play. I mean, and remember, they were kicking people out because their kids were playing in the space. So that's a problem. But when I'm looking at this and I'm looking at the design of the building, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, kind of down, you're right. It's like a box and then down. I've seen these in other places and that is kind of your recreation space. You could have a play field, you can have all sorts of stuff down there for people to do, including places for kids to play. So I think we could come up with something. I mean, I'm optimistic on that one. The other thing, parking. Yeah, parking is going to be a thing. Parking is always an issue. Parking is always an issue. But I really do think we could come to something. I really think we could come to an agreement on this. Again, I've been looking at this project for a while now, and you know, I know this is going to go. It's going to be many places before we see it again. So I really don't have any other specific questions other than also to say that I do think we should look at the MFTE again because we want to encourage affordable housing. I mean, that is, we need to. I mean, to me, that's what we have to. And I think that is a tool in our toolbox that we can use. So I would be very much in support. I know that's kind of a separate process. I was reading the letter from Forterra that even said, it says that the council has interest in this option. Forterra can provide more information about assistance and grant funding that could pay for city staff time to put the necessary policies in place. I think that's great. So that's kind of all I have. Thanks.
Thank you. Tom, you have another question.
Yeah, and on that point, I forgot to bring it up. On the MFTE, Brandon, as this packet gets put together more and it gets more refined, is there an example of the numbers you could put in this that would say, if you were to give some sort of tax exemption, here's what it would be? Because I hear people toss these terms around, and I don't really know how much we're talking about in the way of dollars for tax exemption, what that means to the city in the way of revenue. I mean, maybe I'm okay with that because I want to have this project, or boy, that's a lot and we want to look at something else. So is there just an example that could be put in the packet that would give us a better perspective about what kind of numbers we're talking about when we say tax exemption? That's it. Thank you.
Yeah, we could do something.
Okay, so my comments on this is, well, first, Tobias, I have a question for you. And that was, there was a comment about 60 retailers. Does that mean there's going to be 60 retail spaces, or what does 60 retailers mean?
So if we look at current soup type spaces, like the one by Java, oftentimes they divide the small spaces between two, micro retail. So right now the souk is divided, it's 15,000 square feet plus a restaurant. How many that will be subdivided into, we don't know. It will be, I can tell you, it'll be a minimum of 30. How much they will subdivide it from there, I can't tell you. We're not yet in the sales process.
So it's going to be like one big space, and then they'll subdivide like with soft something, or, you know, movable units.
Well, it'll be a beautiful high-ceilinged open wood space with cross-laminated timber all the way and glulam beams and columns. Between those columns will offer the possibility of demising. Whether they sub-demise within those shops is up to them.
Okay. So, and the reason that I'm asking that is because then that also creates more parking for people that are coming there, that are working there, potential 60 retailers that could be 60 cars, maybe not. So, and that's on top of the 100. So now we're looking at 160 possible cars and people working different shifts. I think that's the big challenge. This is just such a beautiful, you know, project. But it's all about the parking and having to overcome this obstacle of the parking. So I think that's going to be the work with this. The recreational space, however that wants to be worked out, is really within that community that's in there. But the parking is what goes out and affects other people in other parts of the neighborhood. So that's why that one I think we have to go out to the neighborhood and talk to them and say, what's going on, and then be really creative. I think that the vacating the 141st is going to be a really good idea, but to make that really work, you'll have to be, the project will have to be purchasing the right of way on probably on the north side of the street to really get good access. And that's the mobile home park that's there, because then you could have full access to that street. And also you would have to have some way for fire to get through and some of those things. So this is just the work that is set before you, right? It's got such great potential, and then it's so frustrating to have this parking obstacle, because it really is an obstacle. And we really wish everybody could take light rail right now, but we're not there, and we need to think about today as well as 10 years down the line. Metro just had to cut their services, and they're not going to be back up to their full services. The last time I checked was a little while ago. It's for 5 years. You know, so we've just got challenges in the neighborhood and challenges with neighborhood parking and suburban parking. So I haven't told you anything you don't know. This is where we're at. Good luck with your creativity and you know, your outreach, and we will do what we can to support you. We have to be realistic about parking, but everything else, I don't really see any other barrier much, really. You know, the recreational space can probably work out, the multifamily tax exemption. Now that's going to be different, because it's going to be an MFTE on people that are in owner-occupied spaces instead of rental spaces. But I think we can do that. We must be able to. Is that right?
Well, we appreciate the support, Kathy. And we're going to have to be creative. You just popped into my mind the, should we just cap the souk number? Because with HUD, you can't cap the residence number. We'll have to talk to Brandon about that. But we could cap. There's no HUD rule on capping the souk. That could be an option.
Yeah.
But you're right. Yeah, we will be creative. We'll do our best.
Yeah, because when you start spilling into the streets, you've got a residential neighborhood back there. And it's not like city streets. It's like these long blocks and, you know, sidewalks here and no sidewalks there and things like that. So you've probably driven around and seen it, but so yeah, you've got your work cut out for you. So do we have any other comments about this? So yeah, looking forward to our next update. And staff, Brandon, any other comments? Any concluding? This has been really good.
No, so what the next steps for staff and for Tara and the all the applicants is to begin, we want to have a kind of a robust public engagement in the neighborhood. I envision that as being a few open houses about the project so that we get input from businesses and residents and property owners within the area.
Great. So will this come back to PCD this year?
Yes. So, you know, the if we have a draft development agreement, it will definitely come to PCD for review before going to the full council. And we will provide updates as we move through that process.
Okay. Looking forward to seeing this again. Hopefully this year. It would be great if Councilmember Steele could have one more touch on this. I would. Yes. So anyway, okay. So we are at the end of our agenda. Is there any miscellaneous? No miscellaneous. So we will adjourn and I'll see everyone at 7 o'clock.